Primal Leadership by Daniel Goleman, Richard Boyatzis, and Annie McKee. Continued, Cassette 5, Side 1. One engineer, for example, who'd become a strong leader, reported that he'd been able to transcend the command and control, pace-setting engineering culture through a somewhat surprising venue for leadership development, his church. My church group easily lent itself to people expressing feelings and opinions, the engineer recalled, where as an engineer, I usually felt the need to always have a logical flow. In the group, I became more accepting of less structure. Over time, that acceptance worked its way into how I acted as a leader, less concerned with flow and content, and more attuned to group process. Unquote. For most of the engineers that Dreyfus studied, early experiences of being a project leader provided their key leadership learning laboratory in the work setting. Over the years, they took on greater management responsibility, worked with coaches, and attended training programs sponsored by their company. As they continued to refine their leadership abilities, they became models for how stealth learning can go on anywhere, anytime. The power of mental rehearsal. The more time you put into practicing, then, the greater the payoff. There is another way to expand opportunities to practice leadership abilities, by using mental rehearsal. Let's return to our example of Jack. Following part of his learning plan, he began to spend idle moments during his drive to work, thinking through how to handle encounters he would have that day. One day, driving to a breakfast meeting with an employee who seemed to be bungling a project, Jack ran through a positive scenario in his mind. He asked questions and listened to be sure he fully understood the situation before starting to solve the problem. He anticipated feeling impatient and rehearsed how he would handle these feelings, rather than resorting to his usual response of jumping in too soon. Such mental rehearsal can greatly improve how well you learn new skills. It's a well-known fact, for example, corroborated by scientific study, that mental rehearsal enhances the performance of athletes. Olympic athletes, such as the American diver Laura Wilkinson, use it routinely. While preparing for the 2000 Olympics, Wilkinson broke three toes and was unable to go in the water. Rather than stop her preparations, Wilkinson sat for hours each day on the diving platform, repeatedly recreating in her mind a detailed vision of each of her dives. She went on to win an upset victory in the 2000 Olympics, the gold medal in the 10-meter platform competition. There are dozens of such dramatic stories of athletes using the power of mental rehearsal, envisioning their success. That kind of visioning enlists powerful biological forces. For 30 years, a growing body of research has shown that you can raise the temperature of part of your body and slow your breathing or heartbeat through mental training, the right feedback, and the right vision of what you want to do. Accordingly, leadership success depends on your ability to clearly picture yourself achieving your ideal state and then maintaining that focus. This visualization has another advantage. The brain, remember, motivates us by carrying an image of where we're going and how we'll feel when we get there. But the benefits go beyond even that. Brain studies have shown that imagining something in vivid detail can fire the same brain cells that are actually involved in that activity. In other words, the new brain circuitry appears to go through its paces, strengthening connections, even as a person merely repeats the sequence in his mind. That suggests a tactic for alleviating fears that might be associated with trying out new, riskier ways of leading. If you first visualize some likely situations at work or at home, you'll feel less awkward when you actually put the new skills into practice. Experimenting with new behaviors, then, and seizing opportunities inside and outside of work to practice them, as well as using such methods as mental rehearsal, eventually triggers in one's brain the neural connections necessary for genuine change to occur. The fifth discovery, the power of relationships. In the early 1990s, a group of women who were partners in what was then Coopers and Lybrand met to form a study group. At first, they gathered monthly to discuss their careers and how to provide leadership in the firm and in a traditionally male-dominated industry. But after a few meetings, the women began to realize that they were meeting to discuss their work and their lives in general. They developed a strong mutual trust and found they could rely on each other for frank feedback as they worked on strengthening their leadership abilities. Many professional women today, seeking to be leaders or sustain leadership in their organizations, have created similar groups, and for good reason. As we pointed out in Chapter 6, women, like minorities, get shorted on helpful performance feedback. And perhaps most important, people with whom we have a sense of trust give us a safe place to experiment, to try out unfamiliar parts of our leadership repertoire in a no-risk setting. For anyone who has gone through leadership development that works, the importance of the people who help along the way will be obvious. As one mid-career leader put it, during the last meeting of a peer group that had undergone a 2-year development process, it wasn't just the program that made such a difference, but rather the people and the relationships that we have built. In fact, perhaps paradoxically, in the self-directed learning process, we draw on others every step of the way, from articulating and refining our ideal self and comparing it with the reality, to the final assessment that affirms our progress. Our relationships offer us the very context in which we understand our progress and realize the usefulness of what we're learning. Like consulting a lawyer, talking with a trusted coach, mentor, or friend becomes a safety zone within which to more freely explore the painful realities of a politicized work setting, or to question things that don't make sense but are imprudent to raise with your boss. Experimenting and practicing new habits require finding safe places and relationships. We've seen many instances in which such support can offer not just the hope of change, but also the confidence to embrace that hope. For example, at the end of a program for executives and professionals, these already highly successful people reported a large gain in their self-confidence. How did they account for that gain, especially when their peers already had seen them as confident before the executives began the program? In interviews, the executives explained that what had increased was their confidence that they could change, something they hadn't felt for a long time in their professional lives. They reported feeling that many of the people around them, people at work, even their families, had an investment in them staying the same despite their wanting to change. But in the leadership program, they developed a new reference group, others like themselves, who encouraged that change. Moreover, we've seen that result in study after study. Positive groups help people make positive changes, particularly if the relationships are filled with candor, trust, and psychological safety. The stress of leadership. For leaders, such safety may be crucial for authentic learning to occur. Often, leaders feel unsafe, as if they're under a microscope, their every action scrutinized by those around them, and so they never take the risk of exploring new habits. Knowing that others are watching with a critical eye provokes them to judge their progress too soon, curtail experimentation, and decrease risk-taking. In those ways and others, leadership is intrinsically stressful. Early studies on people who had a high drive for power, the need to have an impact, showed that their very desire for that power had the same arousing effect on them as if they were under actual biological stress. When a person's stress increases, or his power motives are aroused, the body reacts by secreting more adrenaline and noradrenaline, the body's stress hormones. That leads to higher blood pressure, getting the individual ready for action. At the same time, the body secretes the stress hormone cortisol, which is even longer lasting than adrenaline, and which interferes with new learning. When people feel stressed, of course, they no longer feel safe and are further inhibited in practicing new ways of acting. Instead, they become defensive, relying on their most familiar habits. There is another problem that the stress of leadership introduces. When stress is high and sustained, the brain reacts with sustained cortisol secretion, which actually hampers learning by killing off brain cells in the hippocampus that are essential for new learning. For all these reasons, learning for leadership works best under conditions where people feel safe, but not so relaxed that they lose motivation. There is an optimal level of brain arousal that helps people to learn, the state in which both motivation and interest are high. A sense of psychological safety creates an atmosphere in which people can then experiment with little risk of embarrassment or fear of the consequences of failure. Being in a resonant group, say one with other leaders like yourself who are venturing together to cultivate new leadership styles, offers one of the best arenas for change. When you see someone like yourself overcome his inhibitions and take a risk, it sets you free to try something a bit risky yourself. Cultivating special relationships, those whose sole purpose is to help you along your path, is crucial to continuing development. Mentors or coaches, as we've seen, help you to discover your dreams, to understand your strengths and gaps and your impact on others, and to guide you through the steps in your learning plan. But just calling someone a mentor or coach isn't enough. The relationship must be one of candor, trust, and support. Mentors and coaches. When we assessed high-level leaders at a large integrated energy company, those we found to have a healthy repertoire of leadership strengths all told us the same story. They had first cultivated the strengths early in their careers under the guardianship of a mentor. That finding confirms studies done by the Center for Creative Leadership in Greensboro, North Carolina, that have long pointed to the power of mentoring to shape a leader's abilities. Reflecting back on their careers as leaders, the executives we interviewed felt that the most pivotal experiences in their development had been jobs where they felt the challenges were over their heads, at least at first. It took a sponsoring mentor who asked them to take the job and then protected them from meddling by helpful hands at corporate headquarters. The umbrella created by the mentor was so critical that the company began referring to this mentoring competence as giving others room to act. The mentors made it safe for these fledgling leaders to spread their wings, trying out new styles and strengths. The mentoring did more than build a core of leadership strength throughout the company. It also produced two successive CEOs, each with laudable track records. If the goal is to work with a mentor in cultivating particular leadership strengths, it's important to make that intention explicit. Working with a mentor who knows what you're trying to do and with whom you share your aspirations and your learning agenda converts the mentor into a coach. Coaches come in many forms. Some may be formal executive coaches, others informal mentors, and still others can be colleagues or even friends. The CEO and founder of Instill Corporation, Mac Tilling, has a mentor who is CEO of another corporation, David Garrison of Veristar Communications. Tilling feels that talking to another executive with related experience helps him sort out issues better than a coach might. On the other hand, hiring an executive coach, and there are legions of them today, can provide the opportunity to talk more freely than one could with a boss or peer. Having a coach, or mentor for that matter, offers benefits beyond simply honing leadership skills. It gives you another set of eyes and ears, and so can be an antidote to the peril of the information quarantine that too many leaders suffer. Coaches help you see outside of the balloon surrounding your daily experience. Good coaches will understand the dilemmas of the organization and its culture, as well as the leader's personal strengths and challenges, and use EI themselves. To be really helpful, a coach will understand the leader's dilemmas from multiple perspectives: the individual level, what's going on for the person, the team level, the group dynamics of the executive or staff teams, and the organizational level, how all of this fits with culture, systems, and strategy. A coach can tailor a leader's development program, offering the luxury of going through the entire process outlined here in a one-on-one relationship. Bringing the whole team along. Helping a single leader move toward greater resonance marks a beginning, but for an entire organization, the impact will be all the greater if leadership growth goes beyond the individual. Take the case of Rosano Saad of Huntsman Tioxide, a chemicals manufacturer in Malaysia. Not long after he was promoted to general manager of operations, he received feedback from his subordinates that jolted him. He tended to be a commanding, pace-setting leader. At one level, this was not surprising. After all, Rosano was an engineer by training, and those styles were the norm in the engineering culture in which he'd operated for the past 16 years. The problem was that he needed to draw on a wider repertoire if he was to succeed in his job. Huntsman Tioxide had been operating at a loss for 4 years. Although the Malaysia plant was the company's most modern facility, it had the worst productivity and quality record in the worldwide group. As a result, the Huntsman Group, a conglomerate based in Salt Lake City, Utah, had bought the Malaysian company, previously ICI Tioxide, for a song, as one consultant said. To help the plant out of its predicament, Rosano used his new awareness about his leadership to set learning goals toward building visionary and coaching leadership styles. His larger aim was to dramatically improve the organizational climate, particularly when it came to people's clarity about their responsibilities and the standards expected of them. He also knew that self-awareness was not one of his strengths, and that became one of his personal learning goals. As a way to inoculate himself from the CEO disease, Rosano made his personal learning goals known among his staff. By involving the many people with whom he interacted daily, Rosano made others part of his learning laboratory. He also brought his whole management team through the same leadership development program he was undergoing. He wanted everyone to be speaking the same language as a way to reinforce their new learning agenda, and to work together in identifying a vision of where they hoped to bring the company. His own learning agenda, for instance, pushed him to communicate the newly identified vision of excellence at every meeting with people in the plants. Teams were formed among the managers, from which they identified a monthly planned personal contact, their praise for internal coaches, for each leader to get support and monitor progress on his or her learning plan. In the monthly management staff meeting, discussions now addressed management style, organizational climate, and learning plans, as well as the usual topics of performance and safety. They also formed special reference groups that met monthly, and within which they could discuss their own personal learning plans, review progress, and get ongoing feedback. Just 2 years later, Rosano and his managers were so encouraged by the changes that they opened their plants to tours and site visits by other executives. The whole environment shifted as well. At the beginning of this process, if you'd asked someone on the shop floor about their personal objectives, you'd have heard something vague in response, such as, "to produce 50,000 tons of pigment." Now, if you ask the same question, you can hear the focus on quality over quantity. "I have to ensure that samples are taken every 4 hours and analyzed according to the right standards. And if there is any deviation from the acceptable parameters, I'll have to troubleshoot to reach the conformance level ASAP through..." and so on. What's more, the company began showing a strong upward trend in profitability, as well as improved productivity benchmarks. Regular climate surveys to monitor progress showed jumps of nearly 200% when assessed by all managers in the company, and by close to 300% seen by Rosano's direct reports, particularly in the dimensions of clarity, flexibility, standards, and team commitment. In the third year after the change effort, the conglomerate's CEO reported that Huntsman Tioxide Malaysia was one of the highest performing companies in the group, breaking productivity targets with record profits. What had happened? The same people were there. Personnel hadn't changed much during that time. What had changed was how they worked together. The climate became one that encouraged everyone to increase their use of emotional intelligence and to build their leadership talent. Each manager had the opportunity to articulate his dreams and aspirations, the first discovery, to see himself as others saw him through 360-degree feedback and identification of strengths and gaps, the second discovery, to develop a personal learning agenda, the third discovery, and to experiment and practice new habits of leadership at work, the fourth discovery. The managers did this work with each other, the fifth discovery, and created a new climate of leadership. They developed emotional resonance about their mission and development as leaders. When it comes to leadership, you've just begun the task when you change a single leader. The rest of the job is to develop a critical mass of resonant leaders and thereby transform how people work together, and then to encourage the ongoing development of such leaders. The most effective leadership development works hand in hand with parallel transformations in the organization that those leaders guide, as we will see in the next part of this program. Part 3. Building Emotionally Intelligent Organizations. Chapter 9. The Emotional Reality of Teams. The top management team of a manufacturing firm had accepted an important charge to find ways to address the fact that the firm was perennially locked in what they called flat growth. Translation: they were losing their edge. The trouble was, the team simply could not seem to make big decisions, no matter how important. In fact, the more urgent the decision, the more the team members would put off making it, careful to avoid topics on which they knew they disagreed. Worse yet, they sometimes acted as if they did agree on key issues, only to leave the meeting and, as one person put it, quietly sabotage the decision. Meanwhile, the manufacturing firm fell more and more behind on implementing crucial strategy. What was going on with this team? Through a leadership audit of the team members, the truth came out. Virtually every one of them was uncomfortable with interpersonal disagreements, scoring low on the conflict management EI competence. Suddenly, the reason for the team's inability to make decisions was obvious. It had never come to the collective realization that open discussion and disagreements about ideas, as opposed to attacks on people who hold disparate views, sharpen decision-making. Instead, the team had adopted the habit of avoiding all disputes. For this group, recognizing that their shared gap had resulted in inefficient team habits was like a light going on. In fact, what they had discovered was an important but invisible force acting on the team. The ground rules regarding conflict and their collective feelings about it added up to an emotional reality that paralyzed them. With that insight, they could see what they as a team and as individuals needed to change. Further, they recognized that beyond a behavioral adjustment, a real solution would require a shift in mindset about conflict. We've seen repeatedly that when teams and entire organizations face their collective emotional reality, they begin a healthy re-examination of the shared habits that create and hold that reality in place. In fact, for leaders to extend emotional intelligence throughout their teams and organizations, that's precisely where they need to start, by taking a hard look at reality rather than focusing first on an ideal vision. Thus, the sequence of reflection and self-discovery is reversed from what it was at the individual level, described in Chapter 7. Why the reversal? It's a matter of motivation. As individuals, we feel most motivated to change when we tap into our dreams and ideal visions of our lives. That vision of our personal future gives us the energy and commitment to change our behavior. The ideal vision for a group, however, is often a much more distant concept, so it simply doesn't provide enough motivation to instigate change. A good example is the lofty language found in company mission statements, which often feels light years away from employees' day-to-day experiences at work. Groups begin to change only when they first have fully grasped the reality of how they function, particularly when individuals in the group recognize that they're working in situations that are dissonant or uncomfortable. It is critical that they understand this reality on an emotional, even visceral, level. Yet, recognizing discomfort does not in itself enable change. Group members must discover the source of discontent, an emotional reality that usually goes beyond such obvious sources as a bad boss. The root of the problem often lies with long-established and deeply embedded ground rules or habits that govern the group. We call those rules norms when we talk about teams, and culture when we refer to the larger organization. Once there is an understanding of the emotional reality and norms of teams and the culture of an organization, it can be used as a basis from which to develop the ideal vision for the group, which, to be truly captivating, must also be in tune with each individual's personal vision. With the reality and ideal vision understood, it is possible to identify and explore the gaps between them and consciously plan to align what's happening today with the vision of tomorrow. The more aligned the reality is with the ideal, the more the change can be counted on to persist over the long term. That type of attuning ideals with reality is what creates the framework for moving away from dissonance and toward an emotionally intelligent, resonant, and more effective group. Before exploring how to make change happen, however, we'll look more closely at the concept of emotional reality. We'll first explore this in the context of teams, and move later to discuss organizations, since team situations are usually closer to people's daily experience. Teams also provide a more immediate venue for change, while at the same time offering a reflection of the larger organizational reality. When teams fail, the power of norms. In the last few decades, much research has proven the superiority of group decision-making over that of even the brightest individual in the group. There is one exception to this rule. If the group lacks harmony or the ability to cooperate, decision-making quality and speed suffer. Research at Cambridge University found that even groups comprising brilliant individuals will make bad decisions if the group disintegrates into bickering, interpersonal rivalry, or power plays. In short, groups are smarter than individuals only when they exhibit the qualities of emotional intelligence. Everyone in the group contributes to the overall level of emotional intelligence, but the leader holds special sway in this regard. Emotions are contagious, and it's natural for people to pay extra attention to the leader's feelings and behavior. So, very often, it is the group leader who sets the tone and helps to create the group's emotional reality, how it feels to be part of the team. A leader skilled in collaboration can keep resonance high, and thus ensure that the group's decisions will be worth the effort of meeting. Such leaders know how to balance a team's focus on the task at hand with attention to the relationships among the team members. They naturally create a friendly, cooperative climate in the room, a climate that fosters a positive outlook on the future. Accordingly, a leader who isn't emotionally intelligent can wreak havoc in a team situation. Consider the following examples. A division of a healthcare company was losing money hand over fist, providing inferior service while employing too many people at every level. The management team was headed by a short-sighted leader and held endless meetings to seek consensus before it would make changes regarding critical issues such as cutting staff. Unable to come to any decisions, within a few years, the ailing division pulled the entire company into financial disarray. Janet, a brilliant leader in a large insurance company, stepped into a sleepy division with the force of a tornado and absolute intolerance for the old ways of doing things. For people on the team who didn't agree with her plans, she had one clear and very public message. There is no room for you here. Find something else to do. Little did Janet realize she had mobilized a force for a new cause in her team, to see her fail at any price. Within a matter of months, what had been a reasonably successful division began performing miserably, and within a year it was dismantled. Unfortunately, these scenarios are too familiar to many of us. At the root of both situations was a problem related to how the leader managed the silent language of both emotions and norms. We take norms for granted, but they are immensely powerful. Norms represent implicit learning at the group level, the tacit rules that we learn by absorbing day-to-day interactions and that we automatically adopt so they can fit in smoothly. When all is said and done, the norms of a group help to determine whether it functions as a high-performing team or becomes simply a loose collection of people working together. In some teams, contention and heated confrontation are the order of the day. In others, a charade of civility and interests barely veils everyone's boredom. In still other, more effective teams, people listen to and question each other with respect, support each other in word and deed, and work through disagreements with openness and humor. Whatever the ground rules, people automatically sense them and tend to adjust how they behave accordingly. In other words, norms dictate what feels right in a given situation, and so govern how people act. Sometimes norms that seem helpful and that are even rooted in noble goals can become destructive. That was the case with the healthcare division example recounted earlier. One of the division's most vaunted norms was a commitment to consensus in the decision-making process. But whereas consensus usually results in highly committed and motivated team members, in this division, the leader had come to use it as a way to stall and even hijack decisions, especially decisions that would move things in a new direction. In the case of the new leader of the sleepy insurance division, Janet's failure to identify the team's emotional reality and to comply with its underlying norms wrought catastrophic results. She underestimated the power of the tribe, the tight cohesion that people feel when there are long-standing collective habits and a shared sense of what they hold sacred. Charged with transforming the division into a state-of-the-art unit, Janet came in with big dreams and a keen eye for what needed to change. Using a classic commanding leadership style, she looked around, found a few folks who looked like leaders. Actually, they looked just like her. Pulled them close and began cleaning house, readily sacrificing people with the least power. When her new subordinates objected to her tactics, Janet wasn't fazed. She was convinced that the senior people would see the need for change and adopt her vision, or else get out. What Janet failed to take into account were the unspoken but powerful norms that had governed the division long before she came aboard. The most important of those norms was a strong bond of loyalty among the team members, who prided themselves on taking care of each other, even during hard times. They had also found ways to deal with conflict that ensured that few people were hurt. By treating people roughly, Janet violated core cultural norms. The team members found their guiding principles, collaboration, kindness, and respect for face, under attack, and they fought back. Within a matter of months, as people came together around their shared sense of outrage, key team members openly tried to wrest leadership from her, while many others chose to leave, leading to the division's eventual demise. Janet is a good example of one of the biggest mistakes leaders can make, ignoring the realities of team ground rules and the collective emotions in the tribe, and assuming that the force of their leadership alone is enough to drive people's behavior. Still, it happens in company after company. A leader walks into a new job, often a turnaround situation, ignores the power of the group's norms, and pretends that feelings don't matter. Rather than using resonance-building leadership styles, the leader employs a steamrolling combination of commanding and pace-setting styles. The result is a toxic and rebellious environment. clearly, the leaders in the previous examples lacked the emotional intelligence to address the group reality and raise team interactions to more productive levels. Leaders who have a keen sense of the group's pivotal norms, on the other hand, and who are adept at maximizing positive emotions, can create highly emotionally intelligent teams. Collective emotional intelligence is what sets top-performing teams apart from average teams, as shown by the work of Vanessa Druskat, a professor at Case Western's Weatherhead School of Management, and Stephen Wolfe, a professor at Marist College's School of Management. Group emotional intelligence, they argue, determines a team's ability to manage its emotions in a way that cultivates trust, group identity, and group efficacy, and so maximizes cooperation, collaboration, and effectiveness. In short, emotional intelligence results in a positive and powerful emotional reality. Maximizing the group's emotional intelligence. Not surprisingly, a group's emotional intelligence requires the same capabilities that an emotionally intelligent individual expresses: self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, and relationship management. What's different, though, is that the EI competencies relate both to individuals and to the group as a whole. Groups have moods and needs, and they act collectively. Just think about the last time you walked into a meeting late and could actually feel the tension in the room. You could tell there had been a conflict of some sort, even before anyone said a word. The group as a whole was tense and poised for a fight. You also knew that the group as a whole needed some action to get back on track, and if it didn't happen soon, things would spiral downward. This is what we mean by group moods and needs. As is true with individuals, in teams, each of the EI abilities builds on one another in practice, becoming a kind of continuum. In other words, when team members begin to practice self-awareness, noticing the group's moods and needs, they tend to respond to one another with empathy. The very act of showing one another empathy leads the team to create and sustain positive norms and manage its relationships with the outside world more effectively. At the team level, social awareness, especially empathy, is the foundation that enables a team to build and maintain effective relationships with the rest of the organization. The self-aware team. An engineering firm's management team had scheduled its weekly meeting at an off-site location. Just as the meeting was about to begin, one team member stormed in, mumbling something about the meeting being held at a place and time that was inconvenient for him. Noticing how upset he was, the leader called everyone's attention to the sacrifice the team member was making and thanked him for it. The effect of that acknowledgement? No more anger. A team expresses its self-awareness by being mindful of shared moods, as well as of the emotions of individuals within the group. In other words, members of a self-aware team are attuned to the emotional undercurrents of individuals and the group as a whole. They have empathy for each other, and there are norms to support vigilance and mutual understanding. So, although this team leader's gesture may have seemed simple, often just such an astute and seemingly subtle move can do more to reduce dissonance and restore resonance than an action full of bells and whistles. Since emotions are contagious, team members take their emotional cues from each other, for better or for worse. If a team is unable to acknowledge an angry member's feelings, that emotion can set off a chain reaction of negativity. On the other hand, if the team has learned to recognize and confront such moments effectively, then one person's distress won't hijack the whole group. That intervention in the engineer's team points to the near seamlessness between a team's self-awareness and empathy, which leads to its self-management. It also illustrates how a leader can model behavior. The leader, in this case, modeled an empathetic confrontation of a member's emotional reality and brought it to the group's attention. Such a caring attitude builds a sense of trust and belonging that underscores the shared mission. We're all in this together. Team self-awareness might also mean creating norms such as listening to everyone's perspective, including that of a lone dissenter, before a decision is made. Or it can mean recognizing when a teammate feels uncomfortable in learning a task and stepping in to offer support. In their research on teams, Susan Whelan of Temple University and Fran Johnston of the Gestalt Institute of Cleveland point out that very often it is an emotionally intelligent team member, not just the leader, who is able to point out underlying problems and thus raise the self-awareness of the group. Such was the case at a strategic planning session at Lucent Technologies. The meeting was going all too predictably. The reigning executive had asked, as she always did, for a stretch goal to set next year's numbers. The team responded with its usual bravado. "Double digit! We can do anything we set our minds to!" But Michael Deschapelle, currently a regional vice president for Latin America, felt frustrated. He knew that the team's norm of public bravado had long masked underlying patterns of ineffective goal setting, which went far to explain the division's slow growth and reflected people's tendency to avoid accountability by hiding behind vague goals. He decided to challenge his teammates. "Do you guys really mean it?" he asked. "Then let's go for 400% growth this year. Let's make that our goal." You could see the reaction on people's faces. They thought he had gone mad. For a moment, dismay paralyzed the group. But after a few minutes, people started to laugh. Deschapelle had called their bluff and shed light on the group's hidden norm of empty bravado. His challenge initiated a frank discussion about how the team had hidden the truth of its performance behind meaningless phrases. Soon, the team was able to have more realistic conversations about measurable goals and concrete steps to attain them, holding one another accountable for what they could achieve as a team. That proved to be a pivotal moment for business performance, creating a new clarity about who was responsible for what. For the first time, financial results for the following fiscal year let the team demonstrate its value to the corporation. They helped to close over $900 million in sales. Deschapelle's actions sparked collective mindfulness, awareness of what the team was doing and why. This level of self-awareness in a team leads to an ability to make decisions about what to do and how to do it, rather than blindly following ineffective norms or swaying with the winds of team members' or the leaders' emotions. The self-managed team. Carrie Sherness, chair of a well-known research group, puts team self-awareness front and center and holds group members accountable for managing how they work together. At the beginning of a day-long meeting, he passes out the day's agenda, along with a list of process norms that outlines how the group will carry out that agenda. For example, everyone, not just Carrie, should take responsibility for keeping us on track if we get off, facilitating group input, raising questions about our procedures, for example, asking the group to clarify where it is going, and offering summaries of the issues being discussed to make sure we have a shared understanding of them. Using good listening skills, either build on the ongoing discussion or clearly signal that we want to change the subject and ask if that is okay. Members of this group, who come from around the world, say these meetings are among the most focused, productive, and enjoyable of any they've attended. This example offers an excellent lesson in how a team led by an emotionally intelligent leader can learn to manage itself. Of course, Sherness should know what he's doing. After all, he heads the Consortium for Research on Emotional Intelligence in Organizations at Rutgers University. But none of the process norms that Sherness passed around were out of the ordinary in and of themselves. What was unusual was that Sherness made sure he reminded the group of its collaborative norms, making them explicit so that everyone could practice them. This raises an important point about team self-management. Positive norms will stick only if the group puts them into practice over and over again. Sheerness's group continually maximized its potential for interacting with emotional intelligence, raised its level of effectiveness, and produced a positive experience for all of the group members each time it met. Being so explicit about norms also helped to socialize newcomers into the group quickly. At one point, the consortium doubled its size, but did so smoothly because people knew how to mesh. When core values and norms are clear to people, a leader does not even need to be physically present for the team to run effectively. This is of special importance to the thousands of managers who work with virtual teams and whose team members are located all over the globe. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.